Good day, everyone. You're watching the debate on Press TV. I'm your host, Behruz Najafi. Syrian government forces, backed by their allies, have taken control of a major town from foreign-backed militants in Idlib province. Now, the capture of Al-Hubayt is the most significant advancement the Syrian army has made in Idlib since the beginning of an offensive 3 months ago. The area has escaped control of the Damascus government since 2015 and is a stronghold for Al-Qaeda-linked militants and other armed groups. Damascus offered a truce, but several groups, including Nusra Front, rejected that. In different development, Ankara and Washington are also planning to create a safe zone in northern Syria. Before beginning tonight's debate, let's go to Damascus and get an update on the Syrian army operations from our correspondent there. Mohamed Ali, over to you.
Yes, the Syrian army continues to advance significantly in the northern countryside of Hama, trying to push the terrorists who are occupying various towns and villages there deep into Idlib itself, that de-escalation zone. The Syrian army on the first of this month proposed a ceasefire, but after several days, terrorists violated it and refused it by attacking government-held towns and villages in the northern countryside of Hama, killing civilians. So the army, after several days, decided to resume military operations and carry out what we can describe as a preemptive military operation to push back those terrorists into Idlib and prevent any kind of attacks, mortar attacks by terrorists on the areas that they control and on the civilian towns and villages over there. Of course, the Syrian army continues with that because of the terrorist violations of the de-escalation zone and because they did not commit and implement the demilitarization agreement of last year, which stipulated that terrorists should be withdrawing with their heavy and medium weapons 20 kilometers from the surroundings of the de-escalation zone. Regarding the northern part of Syria, where there is a so-called deal between Turkey and the United States over, of course, establishing a so-called buffer zone over there, the Syrian foreign ministry expressed full rejection of that, saying that it is in violation of international law and the UN charter, and it is an attack on Syria's sovereignty and unity. And the Syrian army made a very important statement that at that time that it is determined to prevent any kind of division in Syria and will actually safeguard Syria's unity and sovereignty.
Thanks for that update. My correspondent joined us from the Syrian capital city of Damascus. Now, joining me in this debate to discuss the issue will be founder of American Institute for Foreign Policy, Michael Lane from Washington, D.C., and also former U.S. Senate foreign policy analyst, James Jetress, also from Washington, D.C. Good to see you both, gentlemen. Now, the first question for James, how significant is this latest Syrian army offensive in Idlib region?
I think it could be quite significant. This is really the main, let's be honest, jihadist terrorist-held enclave left in Syria. There's a smaller one down on the Jordanian border, but this is the main one. And I think this really comes down to the question of what do the Turks intend? They basically are dealing with two fronts. On the one hand, we have the U.S.-supported Syrian Democratic Forces, Kurdish forces in the northeast of the country, where this buffer deal supposedly now is going to prevent clash between the Turks, the U.S.-supported Kurds. On the other hand, what will the Turks do in Idlib? Will they move their forces in directly to confront the Syrian army? Will they provide support with the Al-Qaeda-linked terrorists there? That's what we don't know. I think what we need to recognize, though, is what lies behind this. A couple of weeks ago, James Jeffrey, the Deputy National Security Advisor, said that the real important thing in American policy right now is to hammer Russia, to make sure that there can be no normal state emerging from Syria, to make sure the Syrian army cannot succeed in Idlib, to maintain that Kurdish zone in northeast Syria, and to prevent Assad from, in essence, winning the war, so there's forced to be a transition. Most normal people understand the Syrian government has won this war. Unfortunately, we still have people in Washington who are not normal people who want to keep this pot stirring and bubbling and the instability going as long as possible.
Michael, in case of more victories for the Syrian armed forces in Idlib province, in what direction will Syria be moving?
Well, I think, I'm going to have to agree with my colleague, first of all, that Syria has won this war. But the United States does continue to have interests and objectives in the theater, in the region. And so therefore, keeping Syria off balance and keeping them preoccupied on tasks that they otherwise might wrap up and then move on to other things is certainly in the United States' interest. And I think that's what the U.S. is all about. As far as where Syria goes from here, well, I think they want to continue to consolidate their gains. I think they want to recapture and drive all hostile forces from their territorial boundaries. And after they do that and they're consolidated, then they'll sit down and plan out what their next move is. We know who their allies are. They're allied with Russia and with Iran. So I think their interests are likely to be allied with Russia and Iran, and they'll assist those countries in their objectives.
Mm-hmm. Now, James, the United States and Turkey have been discussing a buffer zone near the Turkish border that's devoid of any weapons and militants, but Turkey wants to extend twice as much into Syrian soil. Now, what's Turkey trying to achieve?
I don't know what their intentions are elsewhere with regard to Idlib, but with regard to northeast Syria, they regard the YPG Kurds to be the same as what they call the Kurdish terrorists within Syria, within Turkey itself. And I'm not going to dispute their characterization or agree with it one way or the other. They have their own national interests, and that's the way they see the Kurdish problem. They would like to eliminate what they see as a threat from the Syrian-based Kurds, which are supported by their NATO ally, the United States. And let's remember that only a few days ago, people were talking about the prospect that we could see two NATO allies, the Americans and the Turks, clashing with one another in that area. So this buffer zone is an attempt to forestall that. Whether it will work or not, I don't know. I suppose it really depends on what Mr. Erdogan's intentions are and how far he wants to push. If the Americans don't meet some demands he wants to disarm and neutralize these people as he believes a threat to Turkey. As we know, there's a great estrangement between Ankara and Washington these days. So I don't know how much trust there is on either side with regard to this deal or how durable it's likely to be.
Now, Michael, Damascus regards the U.S.-Turkey plan for northern Syria to be in violation of its territorial integrity. What is the United States after in Syria? Well, looks like we lost contact with Michael. Let's go to James. James, did you hear my question?
I did, and this actually relates to something that Michael said earlier, and I don't want to dispute with him when he's not on the other line, but yes, we agree that in essence that Assad has won this war. On the other hand, as I say, Washington is not willing to accept that. It wants to keep things as chaotic as possible, and this is where I disagree with my colleague. I don't think we have any interest in doing that. As he indicated, this is really not even about Syria at all. It's about Iran and Russia, that people in Washington are looking at this in strategic terms. The Russians are bad, the Iranians are bad. Where is the U.S. interest in that? I don't see a U.S. interest in this. I see maybe an Israeli interest or a Saudi interest or an Emirati interest or a Turkish interest. And this, unfortunately, is the way politics tends to work in Washington, is that policy views bubble up from the various influences, very often foreign influences, on our policy. And then you ask, how does this make America more secure? How does this make Americans more prosperous? Well, it doesn't, but it makes people in Israel or Saudi Arabia or UAE happy. And so we will make these commitments, put US forces in danger, get a lot of other people killed in the meantime, or from my point of view, absolutely no national interest.
Mm-hmm. And there's also, James, another aspect to this. And if it is really, if the U.S.-Turkey proposal could create more problems than it solves. You know, safe zones are usually established to protect people in conflict zones, but a 20-mile-deep safe zone east of the Euphrates would have the opposite effect, maybe. You know, it's likely to displace a large portion of the Syrian Kurdish population. It's also expected to worsen the humanitarian situation there. So what's the real purpose behind this?
I think it's a stopgap. I think it's simply to prevent what people were fearing until very recently and still may come to pass, is that it would be a direct clash between the Turks and the United States and our mostly Kurdish proxy forces in that region of Syria. Yes, will it worsen the humanitarian situation? Sure. Will it make a settlement of a war less possible? Yes, of course, and indeed, I believe that's part of its purpose. Do we care? No. What we care about is blocking the Iranians and the Russians, and then let the chips fall.
Mm-hmm. Now, it looks like Michael Lane is back. Michael, if you hear me.
Thank you.
Yes, okay. Michael, I was just asking you about what the U.S. is trying to achieve in Syria, because, you know, the Damascus government is regarding this U.S.-Turkey plan for northern Syria to be in violation of its territorial integrity.
Right. Well, I think, as I was beginning to say before we lost the feed, I'm sorry about that. I think that the United States is trying to disrupt the consolidation of the Syrian government over its country so that it keeps it distracted with that particular task, rather than let it consolidate everything, let it consolidate its power, establish and stabilize itself, and then work with its allies who are already adversaries of the United States. Presumably Syria will also be an adversary of the United States, and create another difficulty for the United States as it pursues its objectives in the region. So that's the United States' purpose or vision in the region, is to keep Syria from becoming part of that triangle of Iran, Russia, and Syria, and being effective at it. Now, as far as what the United States' objectives are in other parts, I think that it's very clear, this agreement with Turkey, we don't really know what's in it yet. We don't even know if it's actually all the details are thrashed out, probably not. But we do know that the United States had some very important allies in the Kurds in the fight against al-Qaeda. They were very, very effective and very close to the United States. When President Trump announced that he really wanted to leave the theater, in part, Defense Secretary Mattis, resigned over that particular issue because he thought we had a moral obligation to stay and take care of the security needs of the Kurds in a post-Syrian conflict environment. So as Turkey was threatening to come into Syria and annihilate the Kurds, essentially was what the outcome of that would have been, the United States really stepped up the negotiating pressure, came to an agreement, no matter how solid or unsolid it might be with Turkey, that precludes the Turkish invasion, and allows a joint cooperation center or a joint command center to negotiate this little buffer peace zone, non-conflict zone, whatever you want to call it, that avoids the war between the Turks and the Kurds. That was the primary objective the United States had. I don't know what Turkey's getting out of it.
Mm-hmm. Now, Michael, James, do you agree with Michael?
I certainly agree with his description. I think in one place he may have misspoken when he talked about the remaining U.S. forces remaining in Syria and their effectiveness against al-Qaeda. I think he was really talking about ISIS or Daesh. But certainly that argument was made by Trump's national security team. Oh, we need to stay there because, after all, we don't want Daesh coming back. But I think even though I agree with his description of what we're doing, I disagree that it could be construed as something benign or moderate. I think quite to the contrary. Yes, it is designed to counter the Iranians and counter the Russians, which he says are adversaries of the United States. There are no particular reasons why Russia or Iran need to be adversaries of the United States. There's no reason why we should be committing what amounts to, let's use the word, aggression against Syria, having our forces illegally on Syrian territory, illegally conducting military operations, and illegally trying to, if not overthrow, a sovereign government, which we've been trying to do for over 8 years, but at least to make life difficult for that government and for its people for purposes that strategically, in my opinion, make no sense. These are the goals that have nothing to do with the national interest of the United States and everything to do with the national interest, or at least the policies of Israel, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Turkey, and so forth, which are so-called friends and allies of the United States, which actually bring zero benefit to our country. And I think that's, we're looking at a root malfunction in the way U.S. foreign policy is made.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me ask Michael if he has any justifications or explanations regarding what the U.S. has been doing there. As James said, the U.S. was never invited by the Damascus government there, so lots of things happening there are considered to be illegal?
Well, the thing that James said that really struck me was that the United States does not need to have an adversarial relationship with Russia or with Iran. In fact, we can find areas of cooperation and we can move forward. And I agree with him on a certain level that that's exactly true. But as far as U.S. politics are concerned, when President Trump came to office, he wanted to get along with the Russians. He did everything he could to get along with the Russians. And both the Congress, the American press, and the Russians themselves would do things that would make it very, very difficult for Donald Trump to carry out his vision of a better relationship with the Russians. So we wind ourselves in a situation now where the strongest sanctions ever that the United States has placed on the Russian government are currently in place under the Trump administration, which was desperately looking for a way to get along with the Russians. On the second hand, the Iranians, we've had an adversarial relationship with Iran for 40 years. It dates back to the Islamic Revolution. Both sides have not been particularly aggressive in pursuing whatever it would take to make that relationship better under whatever circumstances it could be. I suspect that as long as things remain the same, we're going to have an adversarial relationship with Iran, no matter what dreams or visions might be out there to make things a little better. I just don't see them coming to fruition.
Mm-hmm. Now let's go back to the main topic, Syria again. James, the Assad government has managed to get rid of most of the Daesh terrorists who were wreaking havoc to the country for several years. And that's the group that Washington claimed was fighting in Syria. Now, what has kept the U.S. in Syria now that the Daesh threat has been dealt with seriously?
Well, there's a mentality in Washington that there is never a problem with the insertion of American forces, or the application of American force. It's only the failure to insert forces or the failure to apply force that could never be a problem. So you see, even though there was the memo from 2012 from the Defense Intelligence Agency that our continued support for Salafist terrorists in Syria would give rise to a principality in eastern Syria, what became Daesh. Oh, no, that wasn't the problem. The problem was we prematurely withdrew from Iraq. That was the problem that came from Trump's team. We still have this boogeyman being raised that says if we pull out of Syria, that suddenly Daesh is going to make this big comeback. And there's never an admission to saying, well, maybe we shouldn't have been supporting terrorists in the first place. We shouldn't have supported these terrorists in Syria. We shouldn't have supported them in Libya. We shouldn't have supported them in Bosnia or Kosovo. Let's face the fact that ever since the Afghan war against the Soviet Union, we have used these terrorists as foot soldiers, as proxies, and we still use them today. Who do you think these people in Idlib are? Why does the media and the so-called white helmets always come with these sob stories to the world opinion when in fact they're the public relations arm for Al-Qaeda? It's a very ugly side of American policy, and then we turn right around and say, oh, but we can't leave because the terrorists would fill that vacuum. This is how bizarre American policy has become.
Now, Michael Lane, what do you have to tell us about the same thing? Because President Trump was first wondering why the U.S., especially during his campaign, he even made fun of President Obama at that time, why we have so many American boots outside the U.S., why we're wasting that much money. And then he also talked about planning to withdraw 2,000 U.S. forces from Syria, but that never happened. So what's the U.S. doing there?
Right. Well, of course, I think President Trump's instincts are to be less involved and to pull out of the region. And as I think either you or James said, I forget which one, let the regional players sort of that among themselves. I think that the advisors and cabinet that President Trump has assembled almost to a person disagree with his approach on that. And collectively, they've been able to persuade him to go very, very slow in implementing his withdrawal. As I said, last winter, Defense Secretary Mattis resigned over that particular issue sort of a tweet out of the blue where President Trump announced we were going to start bringing our soldiers home without any particular plan that anybody knew of to make that happen and a vision for the future. The United States still has interests in the region, and the best way for the United States to look after those interests is to be in the region physically. And this is what President Trump's advisors have been telling him over the last year and a half of his presidency, that no matter what his instincts are about getting out, we can't abandon our interests in the region to whatever comes out of a collective effort by the regional players there. If you want a vote, you have to have a seat at the table.
Okay. Now, I got one last question for both of you. James, what type of a strategy are Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates following, given the circumstances in Syria these days? You know, the two used to back those terrorists and militants fighting the Assad government, but now they've kind of changed course, especially the UAE, you know, that has reopened its embassy in Damascus.
Yes, and I think we've also seen some division between the Emiratis and the Saudis when it comes to Yemen as well. It seems to me that there is a split there. I can't give you all the details of it. The Saudis, it seems, under Mohammed bin Salman, are so closely yoked to Israeli policy, which also then means American policy. I think we do need to look at it in terms of the big picture that that Michael pointed out. President Trump promised an America First policy. He promised a break from all the failures of the previous administration. But unfortunately, Michael's right. He assembled a team that doesn't agree with him. He got a bunch of people, retreads from the Bush administration, people from the recommended by the Heritage Foundation, and other people who simply want to carry on the same policies of failure that he ran against in 2016. So we voted, we deplorables like myself, voted for an America First policy. Instead, we got an Israel and Saudi Arabia First policy, which is what we've had for all of these decades, and why we keep finding ourselves in these messes where we actually do not have national interests, in my opinion. To say we have interests there, well, yes, we have interests there. We have them in Eastern Europe. We have them in the South China Sea. We have them in Afghanistan and Central Asia. Where in the world do we not have interests that require us to have, if not a seat at the table, the commanding voice? And I think this is where our democracy really is in very bad shape.
Okay, we're running out of time, James. So, Michael, you have 30, 40 seconds.
Yeah, I can't find a lot to disagree with what James just said. I would only say that, you know, we do have interests all over the place. I'm a little bit more of an interventionist, perhaps, than would my colleague be. I can see the benefits to be gained by being there, by being part of the process, by making sure that everyone knows what our vision is as the collective wisdom of the parties combined plan a future for the area. Now it's interesting. I say this not really, not as a joke, but it seems now that President Trump thinks we have interests in space as well, because we're going back into space. So we'll see how contracting or expansive he gets.
All right, interesting. Now, on that note, we come to the end of this program. Let me thank our guests. We had the founder of American Institute for Foreign Policy, Michael Lane from Washington, D.C., and also former U.S. Senate Foreign Policy Analyst James Jatras, also from Washington, D.C. Thank you for watching this program. We'll see you soon.